Our next speaker is a member of the Civil Aeronautics Board, a member, a native of New York City. Dr. Elizabeth Ellery Bailey received her bachelor's degree in economics from Radcliffe College, a master of science degree from Stevens Institute of Technology, and her doctorate in economics from Princeton University. She had been employed by Bell Laboratories since her graduation and taught economics at NYU for 4 years. Member of the organizing committee of the 1975 Telecommunications Policy Research Conference. She is a member in various civic and professional organizations, has received a number of awards, and published 2 books and a series of articles. Let's find out what a woman is doing as a member of the Civil Aeronautics Board.
Thank you very much. I think what I'll do is I'll start with some gossip about how it was that I got nominated, or how it was that they found me. And what had happened was that President Carter had talked to Hamilton Durden and said, well, we've got a Republican slot, and I think what we ought to do is fill that one with a woman. Hamilton evidently got a couple of names of some women that he thought would be good for it, and called in Mary Schumann, who is the assistant to the president in aviation matters, and is a very attractive and sort of dynamic young woman from Seattle, Washington. And so she looked over the list and she said, well, you know, I mean, I just don't know any of those names. And Hamilton said to her, well, I thought all you women knew each other. and then he says, so you think you can do any better? And she said, yep. And he says, okay, you got 24 hours. So I think what she took really was about 48 or something, but got a list of about 45 women and put me at the top of it. And at the time, in fact, since there was a big deadline, I had been up giving a talk at Harvard, and I have a handicapped child, and I had on my way back was looking at a possible boarding school for him, and was giving another talk in Hartford, and they didn't know if I was a Republican or not. I mean, what they'd gotten was all this sort of info on me from various people in economics, but not exactly that. And they finally found, as they called up my 12-year-old son and said, is your mother a Republican? And he said, my father is a Republican, my mother is a Republican, and I am a Republican. It was on that basis that my name went into President Carter. But there is a kind of a moral to that story, and which is why I told it, and not just for humor, and that is that women really can be a great deal of help to each other by sort of pressing at the right time on things, and by insisting that a quality search be done, or that a quality job be done. And in this case, Mary Schumann saw the opportunity, and even though she was being kind of put down about it, persisted and ended up getting someone who I think she feels will be much more representative of kind of consumer interests than might have been the case if they'd have settled sooner. So I have a fair amount of respect for her. In fact, I think that story is written up in, there's a book on Carter's first 100 days, and I think there's part of that story is written up in there anyway. I wasn't going to do too much on my own background except for to tell one story, because it's helpful on how women of my generation recognize their abilities. And that is that when I graduated from college, even though I had done extremely well there, I expected to be a secretary, because that's what you did. And I didn't go to graduate school because I didn't want to teach in a women's college, and that was sort of all you could do. And I went to work for Bell Labs, and first a clerical typing position, and then I sort of worked up to computer programming kinds of things. And it wasn't until I had my older son, who was handicapped, I had him, I guess, in 63, when he was about 4 or 5 years old, it became very clear he's what has what they call learning disabilities. which means that part of his brain was denied oxygen when he was being born and is quite damaged. Other parts of his brain have normal intelligence. And there wasn't any kind of schooling for him, and I was having it where I was. And I was also having a very hard time emotionally coming to grips with that. I cried a lot and spent a lot of time feeling sorry for myself. And I signed up for a program in one of the local schools with government funds, a Title I program for parents of children with handicaps, and went there sort of needing help and discovered very quickly that all anybody did was to sit around and moan and groan with the very similar moans and groans. And by about my third visit there, I was saying, well, why don't you do something? Why don't you do something? And pretty soon, I mean, we started doing things, and I became a vice president of a school that we started for kids in the area, and found that I was really quite good at coordinating and managing things, and could put together doctors and psychologists and lawyers, and could appeal to the state senators, and could apply all kinds of pressures and things. And at the end of about 2 years of that, I really basically discovered that I had a lot of talents that had never come out, had never been asked for in my job, and basically went in and completely changed my job as a result of that. I spent about 6 months saying, it's time I begin to direct my own life. And went in thinking I was going to quit. I went and got myself a scholarship to go to Princeton. And they and at Bell Labs at the time, I had done some research. And although they had very extensive education programs, the women had never been allowed in them. And so I went and said, I've got myself my own scholarship, and I'm going to quit and go get my degree in economics, which is what I want to do. And they said, oh, no, don't act so hastily. And I said, well, there's one fight I'm not going to fight, because I have a list here of women that you've turned down in the past 4 years, and I've had a good experience here, and I don't want to leave bitter because of a huge fight. So if you want to fight, you can fight, but I've got an alternative. And that particular strategy has done me well several times. When promotions came up, I always had a very attractive alternative outside, one that was in fact better than the inside, so that if it was going to turn out that I didn't get it, I had something else that I could do. And on a couple of occasions, it got me something I wanted much better inside, was being really prepared with something that was clear to them was a much more attractive thing outside. So it's a sneaky, I'm not very good at confrontations, and that's a more sneaky way of getting your way, but I found it helpful. I'll describe a little about the Civil Aeronautics Board. I am the first woman who's ever been a member of the board. And I really didn't have very many good expectations when I first. So I'm finding that throughout government by being that same kind of persistence that one is about one's kids or trying to get something else, if you bring that to work, it is very, very helpful. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Are there any questions?
Yes.
You mentioned the board since before Pan Am because of their financial problems. Seems like
I was very much less when I first came on the board a few months ago. I was very unsympathetic toward that attitude, but what has happened, at least in the case, the two most ailing airlines are Pan American and Eastern. And because of some hand-holding that was done a few years ago, but with some tough talk, they have basically really tightened the belt and are now becoming extraordinarily efficient compared to what they were. So it seems like now and again applying pressure rather than letting them go under actually forces them to reassess stuff inside and allows a sort of a preservation of capital. I don't think it would be healthy right now when you're trying to really reform the thing to have a Penn Central or a Lockheed or something. And I've been rather pleased that the ones that seem to be ailing the most are tightening the belt most. But the problem is that there's incentives to ask for things even if they're not healthy for you. And that route, it looked to me like it was not would not be a profitable route, this one for Pan Am, because it doesn't really know this area well enough to do it. It was just the kind of route that was bad to put them into bankruptcy, but that there was no way they wanted somebody else to get it. You know, even though if they were going to get it, they probably wouldn't give the kind of service we wanted. They were trying very hard, but since the rest of the board is so concerned about that, I figured I would be concerned about doing the right and the consistent thing, and I really don't have to. I'm lucky I don't have to face that decision because there are so many of the other, there's always going to be a majority of the board members that will be protective, so I don't have to be. I can be sort of the way you ought to be. Yes?
Is there going to be more expansion than the Dome
there? I think so until the reform comes in. I think what's going to happen, the way the regulations work now is that a sort of a formula based on the total industry average cost is used to figure out what regular coach fare seats are. And you can't either increase or decrease those unless there are really trends in costs over the whole industry. So the only way that carriers can compete with each other in the way of price is to offer different kinds of frills fares. But what's going to happen, I think, if the reform legislation goes through, is that we may find basically much lower coach fares and much fewer of these frill things. You know, in other words, instead of having like a $600 coach fare to Europe and then a no-frills one of $300, what you may have is like a $400 fare for everybody. And it's not quite clear how when the market really opens up, I think you're going to find basically higher loads of more filled planes and much lower prices. Because that the places where there hasn't been regulation, like inside the state of Texas and inside the state of California, that tends to be the way the airlines have ended up. So, yes? Well, there is a standby service to Europe now. They don't have a lower priced standby in the United States. And the reason that they don't is because what people had been doing was to call up and make regular reservations. Say you get a college community, you get 500 kids calling out to make regular reservations. Completely jam up the reservation system using somebody else's name, and then they'd show up and the plane would be empty because, of course, you know, it was all filled with bogus seats, and then they'd all get on at the lower fare. And unless you can have a penalty if you miss your ticket plane, you know, unless you have like a $25 or $50 no-show charge, it doesn't seem like you can have a lower cost standby that people don't misuse. Yes. If the cargo is already deregulated, and I think that was just took place that last week, and I think there'll be major changes in that in the next 6 months. Supposedly, it might be around Easter that the reform bill would go through. And if that does, I think that the changes will be fairly substantial over the next year or two as people kind of respond to that. What we're trying to do is to not just stand by and wait for that. We're trying to do everything that's possible within our powers right now to bring about low fares and to bring about more of an equity between fares and route assignments. I'll give you an example. Right, what's binding us right now is that that you have to, on any fair matter, you have to let people know whether you're going to accept it or not within 30 days. So fair changes go in very, very quickly. But route changes, where you give Laker, for example, the transatlantic route takes 4 or 5 years. And World Airways, for example, has been wanting a coast-to-coast route thing for years. And they made a big fuss again last spring, which is probably why those Super Saver fares went in. And yet World is going to take another 2 years before we can grant it that route. So